Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Smart Talks by the Elizabeth Smart Foundation. I'm Elizabeth Smart, and I'm here with my co-host, Mio Strong, and I'm actually going to pass it to her today to introduce our guest.
Hi, guys. Thanks for joining us on Smart Talks. Today, we have Sean Escobar joining us. We are so grateful that he's here to share his story. He is a survivor and has a very unique perspective and has successfully found justice. And I think that part is so interesting. But do you mind starting off, Sean, with just giving us an overview of the experience that led us here?
Yeah, sure. So I was abused when I was a child. I was 13 years old and I was at a sleepover at my neighbor's house. My best friend at the time, I had two best friends in this family, which was the Van Wagenen family. And I was sleeping over there and I was abused in the night by their father. Their father was named Sterling Van Wagenen, and he happened to be the founder of the Sundance Film Festival. He was he became a BYU professor immediately after abusing me. And he was a very prominent figure in the community. He'd done a lot of movies. One of the movies that he had created had won an Oscar. One of the actors had won an Oscar for that. And so, you know, I don't know how much detail you want me to go into, but and you guys can kind of lead me along, but I just spent 25 years wondering what had become of him and what kind of provisions were in place to ensure that no further abuse was being perpetuated amongst his children and neighbor children, and then later his grandchildren. How deep do you want me to go into this?
I think whatever you're comfortable with. I think people, and especially from the male point of view, I don't think the men don't often have a voice in the survivor arena. So whatever you're comfortable sharing.
Yeah, sure. And as far as the details of the abuse, it's all public. The New York Times picked up my story. It was on the cover of the New York Times. And so it's all out there anyway. But I woke up to him abusing me, his hand down my pants, abusing me. And I proceeded to stir as if I was going to wake up. I didn't know who it was at the time, but I just remember, you know, this hand was doing that to me. And I didn't even really know what on earth he was doing, but I just knew it was wrong. So I pretended like I was waking up and I kind of got him to stop. But I just lay there, you know, and I was kind of frozen. And then about a few minutes later, it proceeded to happen again. And so, you know, same thing, I stirred and he retreated. And then the third time that he did that, I sat up and looked at him. And he was just standing above the armrest of the couch, just behind me. And he was just standing there looking at the TV. He had turned the TV on. It was just a black and white movie. And he was just staring at the TV as if he was watching it with no sound. And so anyway, I got up and I made a run for the bathroom. I got to the bathroom and I locked myself in there. And then he proceeded to come to the door and he said, what are you doing? Are you okay? And I said, no, I'm really feeling sick. And then, you know, a little while later, he'd come back to the bathroom door and, you know, hey, are you coming out? Let's come on out of there now. And so again, you know, three or four times he attempted to convince me to come out of the bathroom. And I think once he realized that I wasn't going to come out, he then went to bed, or I don't know where he went, but he never came back again. And I just stayed in that bathroom all night. Just didn't sleep a wink. And there was a cat in there. The cat got locked in the bathroom with me. So I just pet that cat all night. And the next morning I woke up, and when I felt like it was safe to come out of the bathroom, I heard commotion in the house, like everybody was waking up. And I just went straight to the phone in the kitchen and called my mom and asked her to come get me.
Was there any awkwardness when you saw your mom, or did you immediately feel safe with her?
I didn't know how to tell her. I think it would have been less awkward if my sister wasn't there. I think I was thinking that my sister, she was in the front seat and she's 3 years older than I was. And I thought, you know, that's embarrassing. I don't want my sister to know that. But so I didn't tell my mom for about 10 minutes. We were driving and then she pulled into this drive-thru and ordered a breakfast sandwich. And then when we were on the way to the window to pick up the breakfast sandwich, I just kind of dropped it on my mom and my sister. And yeah, they were just in complete shock. You know, my mom said, well, oh no, you know, and then she says, you're going to come with me to work, and took me to the family business, where my dad was. And then, you know, it was crazy. Cause I was there for a couple hours, and I was exhausted, but I was just sitting in the front desk, and then in walks Sterling Van Wagenen that very, morning. He walks into the office, and then I'm the only one. I'm right there in the, you know, secretary's desk, and then he said, "Where's your mom and dad?" And I just pointed to the warehouse, and then he started to walk towards the warehouse, and I just ran and hid. It's crazy thinking back, because you know it's actually embarrassing, because I was 13 years old and I was athletic and strong, and I mean for that age I think I was. And I was just deathly afraid. So I just went and hid. And I guess he went and told my parents, you know, just came forward and told them what he'd done to me.
Oh, he didn't try to deny it.
No. And I don't know, at that point, I think my mom and dad had already contacted a mutual friend who was a bishop, and told that mutual friend what had happened. And so I don't know if that mutual friend had already contacted Sterling, but I know that he had told my parents, you know, that he said, I know Harold Brown, who is the head of Church Social Services, and he's also a psychiatrist, and he's the stake president over this area, and I'll take care of this. I'll make sure that, you know, Sterling's called in and that this is handled. So I don't know if Sterling came in because he was caught or if he was just being forthright. I don't really remember. But I just know that my parents met with him in there, and he came in and told him what he'd done. And then it proceeded, you know, from there. Go ahead.
I can't help but like wonder, but how did your parents react? I mean, even if you weren't in the room with them, I mean, what happened after? I mean, I'm sorry, like, if this is like indecent curiosity, you can tell.
I think my parents were in shock. My mom was just concerned for me. You know, my dad wanted to kill him, and that's being completely honest. My dad wanted to kill him. But I don't think at that moment when he came into the office, I don't think it really had set in what. I don't think it had set in for my dad. I think it set in, you know, after he left that, you know, hey, this guy, you know, abused your son in his sleep. And then my dad wanted to kill the guy. My dad was very angry.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I can only imagine. I mean, the shock. So I know you mentioned previously that like 25 years later, you wanted to make sure that you were curious what had happened to him. Or so past that incident, did things go back to normal, or how did that proceed? Was he was the dad of one of your friends, I imagine, and a neighbor?
So it pretty much nullified that relationship. That's unfortunate, because, you know, these were two of my best friends in the world. And so that those relationships were pretty much nullified. And well, they were, I mean, I couldn't hang out with them anymore. But you know, even at a young age, I was wondering, you know, hey, I think he's doing it to his own children. I really believed he was doing it to his own children. In fact, truthfully, I thought he was doing it to his own children that night. But I don't have proof of that. It just, something led me to believe that, when he would retreat from me, he was going over and doing that to someone else. And there was rustling behind me on the other couch. And so, again, I can't prove that, but that's one of the reasons I was very suspicious. I was very concerned. I was very worried for my friends. I had a very protective nature. I've always had a protective nature. I've always stood up to bullies my whole life. Even as a little kid, I'd stand up to bullies. And so when I just always wondered what's going on there. And I would always express that concern to my mom. And my mom would say, well, you know, don't worry. His wife, she's taking care of it. She's keeping an eye on him, a really close eye. And I think she's a social worker. So she would say that, you know, she knows all the signs. She knows what to do. And you don't need to worry. And they're not having sleepovers over there. And, you know, come to find out that wasn't true. And that really upset me, because after I exposed all of this, I come to find out they were having sleepovers with additional neighbors. In fact, I've spoken to some of those neighbors, and one of those neighbors contacted me, well, I can't say more beyond that, but it's very disturbing. So with that in mind, it's like, why were provisions not put in place? And I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and act like I knew what was going on, but over the years, I've read so many stories, and I would read all the stories in the news. And then I was like a magnet for sexual abuse victims. It seemed like people would always come to me, even in high school, people would always come to me and say, you know, I was abused. And then I was like, oh my gosh, so was I. And we would talk about it. We would support each other. And so many people. And then I started to realize how prevalent it is and how many people were abused as children. And I could imagine the effect it was having on people, because I knew the effect that it had had on me. And so it just became a very sensitive, a passion of mine, if you will. And so Elizabeth's story, for instance, I followed that like crazy. And I have gone and tried to help find victims of abuse. I've tried to search for them with volunteers. And I get so wrapped up in these stories, because I've often wondered, you know, worse could have happened to me. And what if worse had happened to me? And what if I had come out of the bathroom? And what would have happened? What would have become of me? And maybe I'm like too much of a devil's advocate, but I have nightmares about what might have happened to me if he knew that I'd caught him and knew that I could potentially destroy his career and his reputation. And then what might he have done to me if he knew that and knew that I was the only one that knew that or could potentially expose him. So it's dark, twisted stuff. And I hate to think about it, but that's what was nagging at me for 25 years.
Wow.
It finally did go to court. I mean, he finally was prosecuted, wasn't he?
Not for my story, no. What happened was I was so desperate to know if there was other victims out there. And I was also very perturbed because I had heard from two reliable sources that he had directed the three most recent sets of the Mormon Temple endowment videos. And that was very disturbing for me, because I thought in my mind, in my heart, I thought, something's not right. You don't employ a known pedophile to do that sacred work. And they knew he was a pedophile because he got disfellowship for 2 years for doing what he'd done to me. He got disfellowship for 2 years. But it doesn't make sense, because the very right after he abused me, he was hired and employed as a BYU professor for 6 years thereafter. Something stinks and I don't like it. And so I wanted to get to the bottom of that. And I also wanted to know if there was other victims. And those were the two main things that was driving me. And so I wrote a letter to his wife. I think this was January 2018. I wrote a letter to his wife and I said, hey, I have to know. I have to know if there's other victims, because it's killing me. It's absolutely killing me. And it's also around the exact same time that my daughter turned 13. And so some people have speculated that maybe that was why it all started to come forth for me, because, you know, back in January 2018, I was still active in the church. I was doing everything I was supposed to be doing, but something was just killing me. I had to know if there was other victims. I had to know that he didn't do this to his grandchildren and his children. So I wrote her the letter and I said, just assure me that there's no other victims. I have to know. I can't live not knowing. And I wrote the letter and I sent it, and then I never got a response. And so 7 months later, I began to contact each of his children one by one. And he had six children, and one of them has since passed, unfortunately. But I contacted all five children and I told them what the father had done to me, and not one of them had a clue. Not one of them was aware that he'd done that to me. And I proceeded to tell them that what he'd done to me. And I think you should know. You need to know. You need to know to protect your children from the grandfather. And it was hard. It was brutal. Like, because these are sweet people. These are good people. And they don't deserve this, but, I did what I did. And then one of them was so sweet. And she says, "Hey," and she could see it was tormenting me. She could see that I didn't have closure. And she said, "You need to meet with him. You might want to meet with him. You should ask him if he's ever done this to anyone else. And I know that he'll give you that assurance that he's never done this to anyone else. You just need to meet with him and ask him." And so I that never crossed my mind. That had never crossed my mind to meet with him. But then I thought, well, okay, I'll meet with him. It was pure hell. I got to tell you, like, I was tormented. I don't think I ate for 3 days. I couldn't sleep. I went pale. I was just in this weird state of biological, physiological shock. But something just kept moving me forward. And so the day came to meet with him, and I thought, oh, well, it's here, I'm doing it. And so I met with him, and my wife went with me, and she sat in the other room, and I recorded the conversation because I thought, you know, hey, I'm worried that he might threaten me. I'm worried that if the other victims, any confesses that there's other victims, then he may deny it later. So I recorded the conversation, and in that conversation, I asked him so many times, if you listen to it, I asked him so many times, are there other victims? And he just kept saying, no, never, not ever. He admitted to other things that, you know, from a Mormon point of view are shocking and unbelievable, but and he admitted that he hadn't confessed those things to his priesthood authorities. But he never admitted to abusing other children. He said, I was the one and only ever.
Did your gut tell you he was telling the truth?
Man, you know what's funny is my wife said, he's telling the truth. I can tell he's penitent. He's so sincere. And, you know, he was doing that sweet spiritual voice. And you know, he has this. Anyway, I mean, my mom and dad, I let them listen to the recording, and they were in complete shock, but they said, we believe him. He wouldn't have told you those other things that are so alarming and maybe embarrassing by Mormon standards. He wouldn't have told you those things if he wasn't telling the truth. But something wasn't, I got to tell you, like, I just kept saying this. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, sure. And I just couldn't even form an opinion. I think something was telling me, like, something's not right. You'd never get caught the first time, and they don't ever do it just once. And so, you know, again, this is my passion. Like, I follow all these cases, and I follow them till the very end, and it becomes a consuming thing. And I know that you can relate, Elizabeth. And so we went on a trip to Hawaii, which this was about 3 months later. We went on a trip to Hawaii. It was supposed to be a vacation, and we went for 2 weeks, and I couldn't think about anything else. I couldn't even enjoy my vacation. I was miserable. I was consumed by the thought that I think there's other victims out there. And so on that vacation, I made up my mind that I'm going to put this out there to the world, and I'm going to make it safe. You know, I'm going to make it safe. And I think this was around the same time as like the USA Gymnastics, and, you know, the whole Penn State thing happened a little earlier, and, you know, all the stories. And, right. And I'm just like, I have to be the brave one. I have to be the one that makes it safe for others to come forward, because I owe it to them. And I didn't do the right thing for 25 years. And I got to do the right thing now. And so I did. And yeah. And then, I did it with a pseudonym. I did it as the name David, and Truth and Transparency Foundation helped me redact all the names and modify my voice so that it didn't appear to be me for several reasons. I didn't want that to be me at the time. And then we released it out to the world, and, he lost his job. Sundance Film Festival distanced themselves from him and said that, you know, they'd have no affiliation with him. And that was his claim to fame, was having founded the Sundance Film Festival. And then,
I'm just curious, when you say you put it out there, and do you mind repeating that foundation, Truth and Transparency?
That's
and,
right.
Oh, I've never heard of that. So they help victims come forward in a way that's safe?
They work with religious institutions that they're exposing non-transparency abuse and things in religion. So whether it's Mormonism, Jehovah's Witness, all different religions, they are, you know, abuse perpetuates it within a religious framework. It's not exclusive to Mormonism. It's in every religion. Abuse, sexual abuse, proliferates whenever you have men who are given that kind of power over other people, that kind of esteem. Abuse will proliferate. Anywhere you have suppression, extreme suppression, you will create a monster. You will create an obsessive behavior. I always say that suppression leads to an obsession, which then could lead to an addiction. And sexual addiction in any religious framework is rampant. And that's the reality of it. And anybody that wants to tell me otherwise, well, that's my opinion anyway.
Wow.
As you put your story out there, did you have other people come forward? Did you have other victims come forward?
There was a couple victims that came came and said that they refused to be named and go public, but they wanted me to know that they thanked me and so on. One of those was an adult, and that had been sexually abused as an adult. One of them was so scared. One of them was a child when they were younger, and I don't know the whole story, but so scared that they couldn't even get words out of their mouth. So scared that they're hyperventilating. But then about exactly a month after that recording was published, I got a phone call from Sterling's, one of his children. And they said, you were right. You were right. There's another victim. And thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Another victim did indeed come forward, and it was a family member who he had been abusing more recently. Even when I think it was 2013 and 2015, it was one of his grandchildren. It's all out there now, so I don't think I have to be so careful about what I say, but And he was doing this while he was working on those temple videos, which, you know, again, that just sends it to a whole nother level for me. But yes, another victim did indeed come forward, and they pressed charges. So he is in prison for 6 years to life. And I was there when he was convicted and taken away. And I was sitting there with the other victim. She had read my transcript. The other victim had read my transcript. What had happened was her parents had said, you know, hey, read this, because this is, you know, this is what all the stuff is in the news about your grandfather. And she read the transcript, and then she came forward and said, that's what he's been doing this to me. And so when I got that call, I felt very much validated, and But no, he's not in prison because of my abuse. My statute of limitations had run out, but he's in prison for what he did to another victim.
My goodness. Wow. I mean, I first want to say that no victim, you included, should feel like you were responsible for future victims that he perpetrated. That's not a responsibility that should fall on your or any victim's shoulders. But also, that being said, I think that you probably have saved a lot of people by coming forward and putting your story out there and taking that risk and making yourself vulnerable. I mean, it's definitely not something that you do lightly, you choose lightly. So, I mean, with that being said, I'm certainly grateful that you did come forward, that you did put your story out there. But I wouldn't want you to feel like you were responsible for the other victims that he has perpetrated. I mean, that squarely falls on him. Mm. And every victim, I would want that every victim to know that.
Yes. And Sean, since coming full circle and having him be incarcerated, have you been able to find some peace, or how are you doing these days? How are you feeling? And you have children, correct? You said you kind of, this all bubbled up around the same time when you had a 13-year-old, which makes perfect sense. Something similar happened to me with my two little girls. And I just am in such awe of you. And I'm hoping, has this helped at all find with him, you know, having some sense of justice served? How are you feeling these days?
Feeling great. I wanted to address what Elizabeth had said real quick, because, you know, I came forward immediately. And I came forward immediately because I had really good parents. I had parents who were safe. I feel so bad for other people, children, you know. And my heart just bleeds for them, because there's other people, and for whatever reason, they don't feel safe, and so they don't come forward, or they're embarrassed for whatever reason. And you're right, Elizabeth, we never compare stories, and we never say, well, this person shouldn't, you know, this person over here, well, their abuse wasn't as bad as this person over here. And this person over here did the right thing, or this person over here did the wrong thing, because it's all so confusing. At that age, it's unbelievably confusing. I remember I became an absolute paranoia. And I told him when I met with him, I said, I basically said, you screwed me up, man. You screwed me up. I never had any counseling. I don't know if my parents even understood how counseling works. Like we probably didn't have the money for it. Church didn't offer me any support or counseling, but I became a very paranoid person. I became a very angry person, a reactive person. And I got in a lot of fights, unbelievable. Usually I was defending other people. Usually I'd beat up the bullies, but, you're right. It just messed me up. Okay. So it did, it messed me up, and it took me a long time to admit that, because I was the proud person that was like, this does not affect me. I'm whole. I'm strong. And I was out to prove it. I was out to prove that I am a success. I am, this does not inhibit me. This does not affect me. This does not, but in reality, on the inside, I felt scared. And so when I had my kids, those fears, you know, Mio, you had mentioned my children. And when I had my kids, those fears really began to amplify, and it became, it got to unhealthy levels. where, I mean, it got really bad, where I would go meet with other fathers, or I would go meet with the schooling systems, and I would just tell them, I would just tell them flat out, my, no, you'll never be alone with my children. Men will never, ever be alone with my children. I won't allow it. And it went beyond that. Like my one daughter once went to girls camp, and she'd never been away from home before. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't sleep. And before she went, I called the bishopric and I said, you won't be up there. Like you can't be up. You can't sleep up there, even in a different tent. I can't have it. So, and so how am I doing now? Oh man, it's all heavy stuff, isn't it? I'm doing great now. I'm doing so much better. And I feel like, you know, I feel like you guys had mentioned that a lot of men aren't comfortable talking about these things. And it's this macho thing where they say, well, I'm strong, you know, tough it up. You're a man, tough it up. You know, we don't cry. And that's how I was. I never cried. You can talk to my wife, my kids. I mean, when my daughter saw me cry for the first time in that court hearing, you know, and she's sitting with me. She's 13 years old, and I'm in the court hearing with the other victim, and I start bawling. And I could just see it. My daughter's there. She's just alarmed. She's going up. She told my wife, when dad cries, I she says, I can't do it. I can't see dad cry. But for some reason, I've never had a problem talking about abuse. I've always been, I've always wanted to make a difference, you know, with that. I've never wanted to pretend it didn't happen. I never wanted to excuse it. Of course, I tried my best to prove that it wasn't going to affect me. And so I've been successful at everything that I've done in life. And to some part I've been successful because I was so dead set on proving that I'm okay. But things are getting better and better. And I've been able to begin to understand why I was the way that I was, why I did certain things that I did. I think I've grown a lot in the last couple of years. I think I've evolved, and I think I'm starting to feel better and better about this, but I want to help others. And so if that's true that men are afraid to come forward, which I know it's true, because when my story went public in the New York Times, I had so many men all across the country reach out to me, men of all different backgrounds, all different faiths. And I had so many reach out to me and said, I mean, it's heartbreaking, but I had so many reach out to me and say, that happened to me too. Worse even, you know, rape, repeated rape in the Boy Scouts and stuff like that. And they never told a soul. They never told their parents. They never told anybody. Some of them are married with children. They never told their wife. And so I'm not like a therapist or anything like that, but I've just been able to talk to some of these men, people I just met, and, you know, and we get to know each other, and I've been able to support them as they're able to come forward and tell their loved ones what occurred to them, and they're able to address that abuse. I think that that's the scary thought, is how many people are keeping that secret and keeping that hidden. And I can imagine that if I didn't feel quite whole, I can imagine how hard that must be to live with that and to carry that.
I mean, I think it's so important, and I'm so grateful for you for coming on and sharing your story, because I think it's one thing for a man to hear maybe my story or another woman's story as a survivor, and in their mind it kind of gets boxed into, well, this is a women's issue. But then to hear it from another man, and I mean, I think that takes it to a whole new level and kind of helps everyone realize that, hey, guess what? This is an issue for all of humanity. And I think it helps drive like that, how widespread it really is, and this misunderstanding, and how you need to be macho, and how you know, if you're a man, like, and it happens to you, why don't you just lie back and enjoy it? I mean, I'll never forget. I went on a date once with a young man, and at the end of the date, he is like, you know, he was dropping me off at my house, and he's like, oh, well, you know, you were raped a lot, weren't you? And I was like, oh my gosh, can't believe you're saying this, but yes, I was. And then he's like, because you were raped so much and you realized you couldn't get away, did you ever just lie back and enjoy it? And I was just like, oh my gosh.
That's very insensitive.
Like, I can't believe you're asking that. And then now is, I mean, it's been, geez, I don't know, 10 years since then. Since, I mean, I've been married for 8, so it's been over 10 years. But then since then, as I've gone out and I've spoken with more victims, and I mean, you know, like comparatively speaking, I speak with way more women. There are way more women who I hear their stories. But then as I speak to men, I've heard a lot of them say like that they didn't want to share their story because like they didn't want to be looked at as weak, or they didn't want someone just to be like, oh, it was a woman who like took advantage of you. Like, dude, isn't that every guy's dream? He didn't want to have like those, or these victims that I have heard from didn't want to have like those kinds of arguments, or not even arguments, but comments made to them. And so I just think it goes such a long ways to hear a story from not a story, an experience from you. I think it's going to help a lot of men hear your experience. I mean, so I'm just so grateful to you for coming on and sharing your experience today. I really, really appreciate it. I think it'll make a big difference.
Thank you. I wanted to add to that, you know, one of the main reasons that men are afraid to come forward is because they're afraid they'll be perceived as gay. That's what I've heard from men. I've talked to hundreds of them, and they're afraid that, and also they're mortified because they think that the fact that they hadn't come forward earlier incriminates them. And, you know, or that it happened repeatedly, that they allowed it to happen, not allowed it, but one, for instance, one said, I kept going back and putting myself in the same environment over and over and over again where it was happening. And you know what? We were children. Our brains aren't even fully developed at that time. We don't understand sexual things at that time. So I feel really bad. I really do. I feel so bad for everyone that survives such things. I'm so sorry that it has to happen, that it's happened, that it's so prevalent. I don't understand how anyone could ever hurt a child. I think that the thing that's going to help, you know what? We have to make it safe for victims to come forward. We have to make it socially acceptable for them to come forward, and we have to embrace them. And not have any judgment, and not criticize, and not, you know, and that's where I operate from. Like, no matter what happened, it's like my own wife came forward to me after my story broke. She came forward to me with several instances of abuse that she suffered as a child that she never told me, even though I always told my wife what had happened to me. But there were things that she was hiding. Why? Well, she's afraid I think she was not worthy. She was afraid that I would think that she's tarnished, that I would think she's a liar because she didn't tell me beforehand. If we could all just have absolute acceptance around this, and tolerance, and unconditional love, then we could all heal.
I couldn't agree more with you. We've had many conversations, and in one of our conversations, we had someone on, and she said how she had experienced someone coming to her and being like, oh, well, you were with this person for so long. I mean, you know, like, aren't you okay with him now? Kind of thing. I mean, just, it was kind of like that same thing. Like, why didn't you run? Why didn't you scream? Why didn't you yell? Why didn't you come forward sooner? Like, you know, how do you feel about this? How do you feel about that? And And to her, she made the comment that her response was, well, why don't you go try spending time with this person and you tell me how you feel afterwards? And I think that, I mean, is so apt for each one of these situations. I mean, it is impossible for any of us to judge a fellow survivor, because we will never experience that situation the exact same way that they did. And we don't know what's going through their mind. So the most important thing we can do, instead of judging our fellow survivors, or when we're on the news saying, oh, well, that will never happen to me, instead of sitting there thinking that, I mean, we really should be, we should all be on the same side. I mean, this should not be a two-sided thing. We should all be on the same side. We should all be there in support of our victims. And I mean, there should never be any question. You're absolutely right. And I just am so appreciative of what you've said here today. It looks like we are out of time today, but I want to say thank you again, Sean. I mean, your story is amazing and compelling, and I'm so grateful that you took the time to share it with us today. And for everyone watching, it is never too late to come forward. It is never too late to share your story, no matter what anyone has done to you. You didn't deserve it. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, oh, today I'm going to put get abused on my list of things to do. That sounds like a good goal to have. Nobody wakes up and says that. Nobody wants to be hurt. Nobody wants to be raped. Nobody wants to be kidnapped. And if these things have happened to you, they're not your fault. And you shouldn't feel responsible for another person's actions. But once again, know that there are people, there are agencies, there are services that are available to help you in any manner that you choose. If you want to try to pursue it in the court system, in the legal system, then there are people there who are there to help you. If you just need to talk to someone, there are hotlines, 24/7 hotlines that you can call, human trafficking hotlines, rape hotlines. I mean, they are there. They are available to you. Please do not hesitate to call, to make use of them. And if you are feeling threatened, if you're feeling scared, go to the police, go to a hospital, go to a women's shelter. I mean, you do not need to stay in a situation where you feel like your life is being threatened, that your safety and your well-being is being threatened. Do not be scared, because you deserve to be happy. And I will end my little soapbox speech right there. But I want to say thank you one more time to Sean. You're amazing. I've so appreciated everything that you've said and the time you've taken out of your day to be with us. To everyone watching, thank you again for tuning into this episode. We hope to see you again next time on Smart Talks. See you soon.